I guess maybe if we could start, I'd like to ask you when you started, when did you start playing music and what were your sort of early influences, both musically and politically?
My folks are both classical musicians. I grew up playing classical cello, but I was exposed to folks like Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie a little bit at an early age, and then I went to a camp that was run by Unitarians, and it was in the town in western Massachusetts, which had at that time the oldest online nuclear reactor in the U.S. and a real leaky one, you know, lots of cancer, and the anti-war movement, anti-nuke movement was in full swing around that time, 79, 80, and that was my first exposure really to radical politics, as well as to just fear of my government and fear of the rulers of our society, and sort of realizing at that time that they actually were not sort of in control in any kind of positive sense. And also it was my first exposure to people singing songs about the struggle, really. In the form of one Al Giordano, actually, who is now the editor of Narco News and does not perform. And I don't know if he is embarrassed about his past history as a folk singer, but I thought he was pretty good when I was 12. Anyway, I don't remember what his songs were like, but it certainly got me going.
And after out of the peace movement, were there other activists, were there other activist groups that you got involved with, or other sort of political causes, or kind of how was your what was your involvement like in various movements?
Before I started becoming a sort of a full-time songwriter and sort of, you know, only participating in the movement as a songwriter, now I participate in lots of different movements, in a sense, in lots of different protests and conferences and stuff that are around all kinds of different issues, but I'm not organizing anything, just singing at them. But before I started doing that, I was, I was never an organizer, really, per se. I went to lots of protests and kind of flirted with all kinds of groups that I would view today as bizarre sectarian communist groups, like the Revolutionary Communist Party and stuff, in my early 20s. But I kind of
they're a mouse.
I don't know. Yeah, yeah. I got disillusioned and sort of, I don't know, I guess I'd say grew out of them later. not meaning to be too insulting to people who never did, but I know they're pretty weird.
Because that's one thing I find about your music, is that it's, not only does it sound great, and not only are the issues that are being discussed very sort of cutting edge issues that many people are mobilizing around and being active around, but that your take or your analysis is a pretty profoundly radical one. You're not sort of seeing, you know, why can't we all just get along, or or a kind of this land is our land kind of music, but it does seem to have that content.
Right. Yeah, someone recently was describing me as an ecumenical radical rather than a sectarian radical, but certainly radical. I mean, yeah, I think I think it's so important to have a broad vision for the kind of change that needs to happen, and I really get I feel it's discouraging to hear, like, say, anarchists, some anarchists, really deriding anybody that's involved with, like, third-party politics or something, or on the alternatively, for people involved with, you know, parliamentary-related struggles, to criticize various extra-parliamentary tactics. I think both of those things are really sad, because, it seems to me that, there's certain things we need to be realistic about, like, for example, in the U.S. context, there's no possible hope for redeeming the Democratic Party, and that giving up on that is absolutely a necessity. And trying to form a real grassroots movement that is independent of the two-party system. But, whether that means, direct action or building the Green Party or any number of other tactics, I think, it's all stuff that is good and has its place. And I think, I guess I feel like perhaps you know, maybe just because I'm not the world's greatest intellectual, but it seems to me that anybody that thinks that they got all the answers and that you know, the way forward is inevitably through armed revolution, or the way forward is inevitably through, you know, instant runoff voting. I mean, you know, I think that's pretty incredibly arrogant stuff for people to think that way. Although I think, you know, at the same time that you can say, well, we do need a radical solution of some kind, and it's definitely not going to lie within the two-party system, and it's not going to lie within, you know, going nowhere beyond peace vigils and protests. We have to, well, peace vigils and protests both have a real significant role to play in building a movement, but, you know, I think much more militant tactics are necessary. Which doesn't necessarily mean, you know, of course, for anybody that doesn't know that already, it doesn't necessarily mean, not necessarily talking about violent tactics per se, but definitely, you know, mass civil disobedience at least, you know, is absolutely necessary. I mean, for the, it seems to me, for the anti-war movement or any other movement to really move beyond just being noticed to being actually, to really having an impact, I think it absolutely needs to involve civil disobedience and, you know, things like, you know, mass general strikes and those sorts of tactics at least.
Some of your most powerful and moving songs, I find, are your songs about the struggle going on in Palestine. And I'm wondering when, was Palestine always on your political map, or is there, when did Palestine start becoming important for you, and what were your influences there in terms of the songs that you produced?
It was something that I'd been thinking and reading about for a long time, and trying to write about, and never writing anything decent about it. But then when I actually went to do a tour of the Zionist entity several years ago, and got to meet a lot of Israelis firsthand and sing for them in various strange contexts in the Israeli folk music scene at a time when I felt like I was underground, sort of, because I had my perspective. I knew my perspective about the Palestinian struggle, basically, although I you know, have since learned a lot more about it, you know, the details. But I knew basically where I stood on the issue, but I hadn't written anything about it. And I sort of chose not to talk about it, too, during my performances, because I really wanted to just try to understand these people, which felt sort of disingenuous to me. But at the same time, I felt like, okay, I haven't written anything on this subject, and I could make connections between various, you know, occupations, one occupation and another, but I just wanted to see, like, you know, how are these people going to react when I'm singing about, like, you know, the situation on Big Mountain with the indigenous, the Navajos there being relocated onto radioactive wasteland and killed in large numbers. And, you know, so I was singing that song and just, you know, wanting to see, like, you know, how comfortable will they be in identifying with this and with not making the connections to the Palestinian struggle, which is such an obvious connection, indigenous people being driven off their land. But
and what did you find?
I found that Israel is overall the most racist society I've ever encountered. And you know, having traveled all over the United States, I think that's a fairly significant statement to make, although, you know, I guess there must be other societies perhaps even more racist than Israel. I don't know, I haven't been to places where, you know, various, you know, sort of so-called ethnic conflicts have been sort of pumped for so long to the degree where people really have so thoroughly dehumanized other populations. But certainly from my experience, I've never seen anything like Israel. Although I did meet some wonderful Jews there, religious Jews, non-religious Jews, but especially religious Jews, I found, interestingly enough, because I just didn't realize this might be the case, who were really pro-Palestinian and were, you know, really working for some kind of a just peace. But I guess it was after visiting and after writing, well, after the Al-Aqsa Intifada broke out and I started seeing so much mainstream news coverage of what was happening, and I wrote a song about it, which was then denounced broadly by the Zionist community and supported broadly by the Palestinian
community.
Which song
was this?
Called Children of Jerusalem, from my CD Living in These Times. And after writing that song, that sort of started the whole process of, like, me wanting to really do a crash course in Israeli-Palestinian history and be able to answer the criticism, eloquently, not just, you know, with sort of sloganeering, but really with the understanding of you know, when they talk about this and that happened in 1967, if you can't respond to that and say, well, actually it didn't happen that way or whatever, you know, then you're not going to be able to convince people of your perspective. And so I started, it just became a snowball effect where I was just, you know, writing more songs on the subject because more stuff kept happening, and then just meeting more and more Palestinians and their supporters from throughout the world, and then getting more criticism from Zionists all the time, and it just kind of kept it in the spotlight for me. And I think it also represents this incredible contradiction. I mean, the Palestinian question is, you know, on so many levels, it's like, you know, the U.S. says, well, we're fighting for democracy, and well, here's this apartheid state that they're supporting, and, you know, well, we want to stop weapons of mass destruction. Well, here's this apartheid state that has 200 nuclear weapons, and we're opposed to, you know, torturing civilians. Well, here's this apartheid state with nuclear weapons that's regularly torturing civilians. I mean, it's like, okay, they're right there, and you're focusing on all these lesser cases, really. Or at least, at worst, you know, just, or at best, other cases, but not focusing on, you know, the one that is the richest and has the biggest air force outside of the United States. And, you know, such an obvious contradiction in U.S. foreign policy. And then also, as a Jew, I always felt like, you know, I was so really just ashamed that I get to be coming from a population that, I mean, granted, most Jews in the United States do not support the State of Israel. According to a recent poll, 40% of Jews in the U.S. identify in any way with the State of Israel. Only 22% consider themselves Zionists. The vast majority support a Palestinian state. So, you know, clearly, just based on the mainstream polls, this government of Israel does not represent Jews or Jewish interests as perceived by Jews around the world. But, you know, because if the American Jews feel that way, you know that Jews outside of America probably are even more critical of Israel, because the American Jews are often the most Zionist, I think, of the Jewish diaspora. But you know, it always seemed to me like, how could you say never again to the Holocaust and not say never again to Sabra and Shatila? It's such an obvious connection. It's such a shame that people could be so traumatized by the Holocaust that they could just become blinded to committing really shockingly similar acts towards another population that were committed to them. I mean, which is not to say that there are no significant differences between Israel and Nazi Germany. You know, I'm not suggesting that they're exactly the same. But to call Israel an apartheid state or call Israel a fascist state, I think, is a very accurate statement, and does not mean that it's exactly the same as Nazi Germany was. You don't have to have gas chambers to be a fascist state. You know, fascism is based on, you know, having a government that gives preference to one group and treats another group as second-class citizens, and, you know, makes war on some of those people and makes war on their neighbors, and, you know, and seeks to, you know, large in their territory, and, you know, has no regard for whether they're trading with, you know, democracies or dictatorships around the world. And, you know, I mean, so many ways Israel is an obvious fascist state, just like South Africa was, but people don't use the term because they don't want to be labeled anti-Semitic or whatever. But to call South Africa or Israel a fascist state does not mean, you know, that they were dealing with their oppressed populations in exactly the same way that Nazi Germany was, you know.
What do you think the role of music itself is in these popular movements and popular struggles?
Music has been central to every popular struggle that's ever existed, and I think there's not that many statements that you can make. That you can make such a broad statement and say, like, you know, without exception, every popular movement around the world has had music as part of it. But I think, you know, I'm not an anthropologist or anything, but, you know, I have studied history quite a bit, and as far as I can tell, that statement is true without exception. And there's a reason for that, and a number of reasons for that. I'd say, you know, for one thing, we're just musical creatures, you know. We're rhythmic creatures. Our hearts beat, we have rhythm, you know. Our voices are, you know, highly, you know, evolved you know, things that, that can make beautiful music, and of course we have opposable thumbs. I mean, we're just basically musical creatures. These things just lend themselves to music, and so we express ourselves through music, and music inspires us and gives us a sense of community, and it just does all these things that everybody knows that music does if you ever stop to think about it. I mean, most people just, you know, play music in one form or another, and they don't really think about, you know, the sociological impact of it on them and on society, but it's there, clearly. And it's also, I think, interesting to note, I always like to mention that, you know, not only do social movements always have music, but in a much more artificial way, corporations and governments and militaries all really employ music, you know, to their own ends, you know, whereas, like, I mean, they have to, you know, pay somebody to come up with a song for their commercial in order to sell it, because music sells things better, because people identify with music, but the actual social movements, I can't remember who said this, but lots of people have said it, that, the real social movements, you know, whether it is a real social movement, you can kind of measure the pulse of the movement based on how much art is it creating, you know, because it's just, if it's a real mass movement, then people do the things that masses of people do, and one of those things is writing songs and making billboards and, you know, artwork and coming up with comedy and theater and, you know, all these things. And so, you know, you can see that, for example, you know, the labor movement in the 30s, or the movement of the unemployed, or the anti-war movement in the 60s, or the environmental movement in the 80s, the anti-nuke movement, the feminist movement in the 70s. I mean, you can see that, you know, all these movements were clearly mass movements because, you know, they produced, you know, great artists, great musicians, great intellectuals, great playwrights, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can see, like, for example, that, you know, I could certainly piss people off by saying this, but you can see that the modern day labor movement in the U.S., you know, really doesn't produce a hell of a lot of music, or a hell of a lot of anything else, other than, you know, corrupt union leaders who, you know, give homage to Kennedy or something for being a great man and all this, you know.
Has most of your political activity and or most of your life in the United States been based in a certain geographic region and been influenced by certain struggles there? I mean, I notice that you have a number of songs about Earth First, and it's a song for Judy Berry, and a number of songs that seem to speak to a sort of certain West Coast radical environmentalism.
Yeah.
Is that something that you've participated in and been a part of, or is it just some places that you visited? Or?
Yeah, I lived for maybe a year altogether in San Francisco, and, you know, two years altogether in the Bay Area generally, and I also lived in Olympia and Watt and Seattle for years, and I traveled in between a lot sort of participated musically anyway in the Earth First scene, and locally and at Tree Sits and at Earth First gatherings, and so definitely the radical environmental movement has been a big part of my life, especially earlier on, I guess, for me. I guess I've gotten more into making connections between different things and still writing some songs that are related to the radical environmental movement, but I guess you know, foreign policy has become a bit more of a focus for me over the past few years for, I hope, fairly obvious reasons, especially since September 11th. But,
there's often a dichotomy between sort of radical environmentalist groups and sort of labor struggles or mm-hmm. what are commonly seen as working class struggles or anti-racist movements. Do you see things in the radical environmentalist movement that can provide inspiration or lessons or a sort of way forward for other parts, other social movements?
Absolutely. I mean, and I also think that the radical environmental movement needs to and is, to some degree, learning a lot from the labor movement as well, and from the ideas of the labor movement. And I think, you know, groups like the Society, what is it, the American, I don't remember what it's called, the Society for Jobs and the Environment, ASGAJE or ASEJ or whatever, that kind of development, I think it was originally a sort of collaboration between the Steelworkers Union and the David Brower's environmental group, whatever it was called, Earth Island Institute, maybe. And they have a magazine, and they do lots of different events together trying to make these connections. But, I mean, I think in terms of the rest of the movement, learning from the radical environmental movement, I mean, anybody who you know, was at Seattle or was familiar with Seattle or so many other mass protests that we've had realizes that so many of the tactics that were used, the lockdowns, the tripods, the, you know, the banner hangings, I mean, so many of these kinds of things were, you know, not necessarily, you know, pioneered completely by Earthverse, but some of them were, and others were really popularized and gotten more, you know, professional, you know, in terms of the execution by various Earthverse, smaller Earthverse campaigns. And I think, you know, there were a lot of veterans of various you know, forest defense campaigns who were at the forefront of a lot of the stuff that was going on in Seattle and in D.C. at A16 and various other global justice-related protests around the world. But I think also, in, you know, at the same time, you know, the kind of work that Judy Berry did and the kind of work that needs to be done still to such a large degree to, you know, make these connections. Like, I mean, so many people in the Earthverse movement, you know, their orientation is we need to save nature for the sake of saving nature, you know, and certainly also for, so humans can have air to breathe and stuff like that. But making the other connections, which I think are, well, some people feel are either just things they don't think about or things that they think should be just overlooked because they're not as relevant, I think are actually really relevant. Like, you know, just stuff like, you know, the forest protection and selective logging is something that can, you know, not hurt the soil and can go on indefinitely and employs something around like 20 times as many loggers in the long run as clear cutting does. And the thing is, when you on the West Coast and you talk to loggers, you know, once they often, you know, get over their initial defensiveness or whatever, they'll tell you, I've had this happen many, many times where they say that they realize that what they're being told to do, this clear cutting, is unsustainable, and they realize that the main problem is the company, you know, telling them to do this. And there's a reason why you don't have a big timber industry in Minnesota anymore, and it's because they cut all that down, and now they just continue to move west, and now they're moving back east, now that they've, you know, largely destroyed the West Coast. Now, at last I heard chainsaw sales were bigger in the southeastern U.S. than they are in the northwestern U.S. Now they're logging the hell out of Alabama and Georgia and Tennessee and all these other places around there. Because the trees are now, you know, pretty good-sized second growth, and pretty soon they'll be toothpicks again.
What do you see as the implications of September 11th and the, I guess, militarization of U.S. society and increased repression as represented by the Patriot Act and the sort of various policy decisions of the Bush government? Has that fundamentally changed activism and radical organizing in the States, or is this just more of the same on a similar continuum of repression that rises and falls based upon where social movements are at?
Combination of both, I'd say. I mean, and it's also been a favorite subject of mine, but like a song I wrote that's on my most recent CD called Reichstag Fire makes the connection, which I think is a fairly obvious one, between the Reichstag Fire and the Parliament burning down during Nazi Germany time that gave Hitler the sort of justification for rounding up a million communists and sending them to their camps. You know, this is you know, whoever actually carried out the 9/11 attacks, and of course without any truth commission, you know, at least, you know, without one that's headed by some you know, outrageous person like Henry Kissinger or something, that's just such an incredible joke. But, you know, without a real truth commission, of course, we will never know who did what on September 11th, who knew what, you know, or any of that stuff. But whoever did it, you know, it was used as an opportunity for the U.S. government to further plans that, bipartisan plans, I think is important to add, that they had for world domination, you know, which they had already been carrying out for a large degree, but, you know, it was a perfect opportunity to invade Afghanistan and to try to vilify the Iraqi government more and to clamp down on civil liberties and target Muslims in the U.S. and all these kinds of things they've done, I think, are basically things they've been wanting to do for a long time, and they've just taken the opportunity. But as far as how it's affected organizing, I think that it's affected in different ways. I mean, for one thing, it certainly gave rise to a bigger anti-war movement than we've seen since the 60s. So that's, you know, a positive way that it's affected things. I mean, people are more and more just outraged with Bush and just appalled and just, you know, are more and more comfortable with speaking their minds publicly about it. But and I think to a large degree the global justice movement was really able to switch gears and incorporate military policy more into their analysis of economic policy. But I think that needs to happen to a larger degree. And there's been a lot more sort of fear on various parts, especially on the parts that weren't really into it too deeply in the first place, like the labor movement, in terms of like doing mass civil disobedience. There's much more of a sort of fear of alienating the public or something with more militant tactics, which are the kinds of tactics that people were planning on carrying out, you know, in September, before September 11th happened. That, you know, the plans for these protests in D.C. were apparently going to be quite something, like perhaps something unlike anything we had seen in years. So, but of course that was derailed.
How do you distribute your music, or how can people get a hold of your songs or hear more about you?
Pretty much, I don't have much distribution to speak of, although AK Press is going to be doing my Best Of CD in December, and they're going to have some good distro. And my latest CD is on Ever Reviled Records, and they're getting it out to the stores to some degree. But basically, I don't have distribution with any real distributor for the moment. And mostly, my stuff can be just gotten at shows or through my website, which is davidrobics.com. And also, I make all my songs available for free download on the website.
Can you tell us the names of all of your various albums?
Sure. Return came out just a couple weeks ago, and it's largely focused on the Palestinian struggle and other things as well. And it has a whole bunch of other musicians on it. It's a real studio project, and I'm really excited about it. And then in 2002, I came out with Hang a Flag in the Window, which is pretty much just me and another singer singing with me, and largely songs about, you know, the so-called war on terrorism. And 2001, just after September 11th, I came out with Living in These Times, which is also focuses a lot on anti-war stuff, but also the global justice movement and other things, the media. And then 2000, I came out with Live at Club Passim, which I recorded with a bluegrass band. And 1998, We Just Want the World, which was another sort of studio CD that I did in Boston, which was just a bunch of other original songs about different subjects, environmental, labor, anti-war kind of focused.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Thank you, Tom.